You are listening to the Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesyncbook.com. Welcome, everyone. Marty here once again. Thanks for joining me. I hope everyone is doing well. Just wanted to let everyone know that this will be the last podcast of the season. I will be taking the next 3 months off or so to prepare for some engagements I have coming up and focus on writing and research. And so the podcast will be put on hold until then. And honestly, I just need a little breather. I just need a little time to myself to live my life, enjoy the spring, summer a little bit. I do really appreciate everyone who has tuned into the show. I have been doing this for about 10 months straight now, and it's been really rewarding and exhausting and enlightening and stressful and all that. But right now I'm trying to buy a little extra time to hopefully finish up my next manuscript, Pi in the English Alphabet Volume 3, to be released, if all goes well, this year yet. So I'm hoping to fire this podcast back up during the Modern Knowledge Tour in Canada this August. Please check out modernknowledge.ca for all the info. I'm going to be speaking with Alex and Allison Gray, Nassim Haramein, Scott Onstott, Dr. Robert Schock, Edgar Mitchell, and a host of others. So please check out that site, and I do hope to see you in one of the many cities we will be stopping in. I still have many guests lined up on the roster that I'm going to be speaking with, that I had planned on speaking with anyway. Daniele Bolelli, philosopher Daniele Bolelli, psychedelic artist Alex Gray, Luke Radowski of We Are Change, as well as several others. So I will keep you up to date via Facebook and Twitter and the like if and when all of that happens. But for now, I get to send this season the show out. I get to send it off with a bang. I got to speak with Dennis McKenna, and Dennis and I had a great conversation about his book, The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss, My Life with Terence McKenna, as well as we hit on a host of other issues and topics, and so you are all in for a real treat. Alrighty, kids, let's do this. Our guests tonight are author, ethnopharmacologist, and philosopher Dennis McKenna, and the musical guest is Three for Silver. Thank you for listening to this broadcast from SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune into our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, Marty Leeds, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of these, as well as our books and videos at thesyncbook.com. Our guest tonight is Dennis McKenna. Dr. Dennis McKenna is an ethnopharmacologist, lecturer, and author, and is the brother of well-known psychedelics proponent Terence McKenna. Dennis is a founding board member and the director of ethnopharmacology at the Hefter Research Institute, which is a nonprofit organization concerned with the investigation of the potential therapeutic uses of psychedelic medicines, as well as the assistant professor for the Center of Spirituality and Healing at the University of Minnesota. So without further ado, let's get pious with Dennis McKenna. Dennis, welcome to the show. I appreciate you taking the time to stop by and talk with me.
It's my pleasure, Marty. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, I know you're a busy guy, so it's cool. It's just a real pleasure to speak with you. I've been a big fan of your work for quite a long time, so this is going to be cool. I didn't get all the way through your book. I was hoping to get through your book before this conversation, but as far as the tortoise and hare, I'm kind of the tortoise when it comes to reading, kind of a slow reader. So
I understand.
Yeah.
Well, keep a plugging.
Yeah.
and speaking of plugging, we can plug now or later if you'd like.
Oh, well, let's just talk about the book, because what I've read thus far, I'm really enjoying it. The first thing that really jumped out at me was how like absolutely candid you were about everything. I mean, you left no stone unturned, albeit the relationship with your brother and your father and life in Colorado. I mean, what was it like going through all that again?
Well, it was interesting. To try to remember and relive all that stuff, because actually, you know, it's a lesson in memory and how what an ephemeral thing memory is, and you know, how much I've forgotten. I mean, people say, "Oh my God, this book is so detailed." You know, they don't know the half of it. I mean, because there's no way for the reader to know what was left out. You know, and in fact, myself, there's no way to know. You know, memory reconstructs the past in the way you think it happened, but other people may differ. And so it's interesting, but it was a good exercise to kind of go back through all that and think back that far. And that's also the appalling part of it as well. You know, when you realize you actually have lived long enough to look back 60 years or more, I mean, it's kind of a shock when you think about it, because I turned 64 last December, but I don't feel 64. I don't know how you're supposed to feel when you're 64. It just seems that life is, you know, it's a paradox. The older you get, the faster time seems to flow. Mm-hmm. So that is disturbing in some ways. But it was a good exercise to write it for me on a personal level. And, you know, I also never really had the chance. I mean, Terrence has written True Hallucinations and many other books, but True Hallucinations is kind of the personal narrative of what became of us, what befell us, I guess you could say, mm-hmm. when we went to South America in search of this shared obsession, you know, about DMT. And we knew we were getting into some deep waters. We had no idea how deep, and we had no idea really what we were looking for. I mean, that's why it was, you know, our quest was couched in terms of, you know, the quest for the secret and all that. And, the secret, what was the secret? I mean, even we didn't know when we set out. We thought the secret was to, you know, that the rationale for the trip was to seek this rare orally active form of DMT, this orally active DMT preparation. Mm-hmm. That turned out not really to be the secret at all. I mean, when we finally found it months later, and after, not on the first trip, but on actually Terrence went into La Chirera on a second time and found it, but it wasn't really that interesting. You know, when we finally got our hands on it, we found the real secret the first time that we got to La Chirera, which turned out to be the psilocybin mushrooms. You know, and if you've gotten past that part, then you know that, you know, once we got to La Chirera and started, you know, taking these mushrooms in what was probably a fairly cavalier and unconscious way, you know, but things quickly, you know, developed from that, and you know, the level of the weird rose rather quickly and led us down some pretty interesting primrose paths, you know. So I should mention before we get too far, mm-hmm. the name of the book is The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss, My Life with Terrence McKenna, right? So it's self-published, but it's on Amazon, and you can actually order it from the website of the same name, brotherhoodofthescreamingabyss.com. And if you do that, you can get a signed copy, and I'll, you know, I'm the shipping guy. I'm everything, because this is a self-published book, mm-hmm. you know, so I don't have minions running around doing things. I'm the one that ships them out for...
You don't have little machine elves going around taking care of
stuff? I wish. We have our best people working on it, but the damn things are hard to control. And they don't work very hard.
They work fast. They just won't freaking listen.
They just won't listen. They have their own ideas.
So this book was I'd heard that this was like the most successful book campaign on Kickstarter, like self-published. Is that true?
At the time, apparently it was. Yeah, I think there have been campaigns since that have beaten it. But we raised on Kickstarter, we raised about $85,000.
Oh, geez. Wow.
Which blew me away. And then we raised another $10,000 through other sources, people that wanted to support it but didn't really want to go through Kickstarter, didn't want to have their personal information recorded and all that. So we found some side channels, but altogether we raised about $95,000.
Wow. So there was a ton of interest in this, obviously. What did you feel like, sort of because you were in the position that you're in, sort of obligated to write this book in one way?
No, I wasn't really obligated. It was definitely something I wanted to do. I was surprised at the response in some sense, because I just didn't think that. I mean, the Kickstarter thing was a complete gamble. I had no idea what I was doing. Kickstarter hadn't really gotten started. It was just a new thing back in 2011. And it was actually Terrence's former editor, Dan Levy. I had been in New York and I was talking to him and I said, Dan, I'm thinking about writing this book and maybe you could give me some leads to publishers. I'd like to get an advance for it. And he said, well, you know, there's this whole new thing happening, this Kickstarter. Why don't you give that a try? And so I said, well, what have I got to lose? So I just put it out there. And the thing that made it successful, it's not really about me. It's that I think Terrence has a really extensive fan base. Mm-hmm. Even now, he's beloved and remembered and he's still very much of the, you know, part of the conversation since he's, you know, all over the net still and has taken up, you know, a lot of territory in YouTube and all that. So his people are very much aware of him. And so when I put it out that I wanted to write this book, which is basically my side of the story, you know, because he was able to write his side from his perspective. And if you've read True Hallucinations, have you read that one?
Yeah. I think I've read all of Terrence's work, and then with yours as well, because I know that you both co-wrote what Invisible Landscape together, right?
We co-wrote Invisible Landscape and also the Magic Mushroom Grower's Guide, but we did that under pseudonyms. Mm-hmm. At the time, it seemed, I don't know, it was probably not necessary. But anyway, we thought up some cool pseudonyms and wrote that together. But Terrence is, I think a lot of what Terrence has written is, it's mostly great stuff. It's some is more accessible than ever than other parts of it. But I think that True Hallucinations is probably the best thing he's written because it's the most personal thing. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just about this adventure that we had that two obsessed, crazy people in the late 60s pursuing this, this holy grail, literally kind of a holy grail. But he tells it from his point of view. And I am very much part of True Hallucination. I'm a character in True Hallucinations, but I don't really have a voice in it. Mm-hmm. So I kind of thought, well, I should write a book where I'm the narrator and I tell it from my perspective, you know, which I did. That was part of it. I also wanted to, so that was a motivation was basically to tell my part of the story. You know, another part of it was very personal. I just felt that I felt compelled to do it, and I wanted to tell the story. I did the Kickstarter so that I could you know, essentially by time. I mean, it paid for the publishing of the book and the promotion, but it essentially it bought a year's worth of time. And that's what you need to write a book like that. You need big blocks of time where nobody's making demands on you. Mm-hmm. And so the Kickstarter campaign made that possible. And it was, for me, it was psychologically a pretty healthy thing to do. It was a cathartic experience for me. And I wanted to get something out. I mean, there was, at the time I was finishing it up, there was so much expectation around 2012 and all that. Mm-hmm. And so, I suppose there was a mercenary motive, but not entirely. It was just, it seemed like that was the appropriate time frame to bring out this book because interest was high. And the thing about Kickstarter was, you can raise all this money, but the money runs out eventually. So, and you've got 1,000 Kickstarter supporters or more who have donated money, so they expect a product, you know. Mm-hmm. You can't dither around for years and years writing the book. They want something. They want something for their money, or there are going to be 1,000 people with pitchforks and torches on your lawn. Yeah. So that's a real motivator to get it
start
done.
To kick you, right?
Yeah, right. So that's a good reason to get it done, and I did. And, you know, I could have taken 6 months or another year and maybe made it smoother, but I felt like it was ready. I don't feel like it was rushed at all, you know, because yeah. I did have the time to work on it thoroughly, and it just seemed reasonable to try and get it out in December of 2012, and that's what happened.
What was it like to write in this sort of fashion? Because I'm guessing, like more personal, introspective, the way that you have. Like, I'm guessing most of the stuff that you normally write is what's, you know, like doctoral or whatever, I guess is the word I'm looking for. So what was that transition like going from, you know, a very personal account as to what you normally write?
Well, it was very refreshing. You know, it was a lot more fun, yeah, because... Mm-hmm. Because you're right, most of the stuff that I write is either scientific papers or I do a lot of consulting for different companies. So these are technical, pretty technical papers, you know, as boring as they can be, you know, even though the subject might be intrinsically interesting, it's just, you know, it's not written for excitement. It's not personal and there's no poetry in it or anything. This was a book from my heart and this was really it was written out of love for my brother. In some ways it was a tribute to him and to us It was just a very personal thing in that sense. It was very rewarding. But then in terms of some of the other, some of the tenets of the intellectual structure that Terrence was very much about, that really the two of us in some way over time, we constructed it together, mm-hmm. And the whole time wave zero thing, that wasn't really my thing, but I was in on it when it was created. The whole speculation about psychedelics and the experiment at La Chirera, that was very much my thing. But I never really had a chance to explain all that to unpack it in detail and say what in fact was going on down there and why did it turn out to be so bizarre, because you can look at it from one perspective and you can just say, well, this was two drug crazed brothers undergoing simultaneous psychoses and that's what it was, and it was no more than that. And to some extent, you'd be right if you described it that way. But I feel that it was more than that, you know. And I mean, I'd like to think it was more than that. I don't really want to be known primarily for, you know, my psychosis when I was 20. You know, I've done a few things. I mean, and that's really true. You know, in some ways, our lives, Terrence and my life, our lives are sort of defined by what was pre-Lotcherera and what was post-Lotcherera. Mm-hmm. You know, it was definitely a pivotal point in our lives.
Why did he end up becoming sort of the mouthpiece for all of this stuff that you were kind of constructing together, while you kind of went into the shadows in one respect?
Well, that's a good question. I didn't really go into the shadows, yeah. But I didn't want to be. Well, he was. I mean, one way to put it was, you could say that, you know, I recovered, and he didn't. You know, if you want to look at it, that's one way to look at it. I mean, if you buy into the model that this was some kind of pathological thing, which I do not think it was. I think there was stuff going on. I think what we underwent, you could say, well, it was a prolonged psychosis. There's a model for that. But the model that fits the facts more, I think, is shamanic election. Uh-huh. You know, and that said, I'm not saying I'm a shaman. I do not claim to be a shaman at all. But what happened to us at Lotcherera, we set ourselves up for a prolonged, you know, essentially journey or journey through non-ordinary reality, in which many of the themes, you know, you encounter in classical shamanism. You know, the shaman has to travel to the Axis Mundi and ascend the Axis and go to another world and take back information. And there's often a phase where the person is torn completely apart and then put back together, but put back together in a different way. Mm-hmm. In shamanism, there are themes of putting crystals and other objects inside a person. And this was very much the archetypal, you know, drama that we were playing out. We were creating this for ourselves, even as, you know, we were making up the script, even as we were acting it out. Yeah. You know, the whole idea that if you take a mushroom, if you listen to the sounds that you can hear inside your head on high doses, you make those sounds, you can imitate those sounds. You can do things on, you know, you can operate on DNA using resonant frequencies and actually do a kind of a genetic re-engineering of yourself. And that's classic shamanism.
And this is something you talk about in The Invisible Landscape, and this is something that later that modern science had actually has considered, right? Or has made some breakthroughs with? Am I accurate in saying this?
There are, yeah, to some degree. I mean, not quite in the way that we envisioned it, but not everything about the you know, the premises of the experiment at Lotcherera were complete bunk. I mean, a lot of it was bunk, you know. And I'm the first to admit that, because when you look back at it, you can see that, you know, this is a really crazy, you know, sort of idea complex, full of holes, big enough to drive a truck through. But that said, certain things that we intuited, I guess you could say, or that were told to us because we were getting this big download, have sort of stood the test of time. You know, the notion that DNA can be superconductive, that you know, that these harmine and these other beta carbolines and tryptamines as well can intercalate into DNA, can interact with DNA and get between the base pairs. That's all been demonstrated, you know. Now, it's not clear that that goes on in the body, but it certainly goes on in the test tube. And there are, you know, and then you look at other, you know, other techniques using sound. I mean, sound is emerging as, you know, very interesting tool for altered states, especially in conjunction with these psychedelic substances. So you can get to some very strange and interesting places, you know, through that combination. But, you know, when we went to La Chorrera, we were seeking something. We weren't sure what. We were so clueless about what we were looking for. We didn't even have any idea how clueless we were. That's how clueless we were. You know, we actually thought we knew something. You know,
in one respect, you could chalk it up to like being young and naivete and that sort of thing. But in another respect, you could say the same thing about your Kickstarter campaign. You had no idea what you were doing when you were going in. You had no idea what the product you were going to be. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it was a similar thing with a major difference. Yeah, I had no idea.
Like, just because you don't know what you're doing when you go in doesn't mean you're not going to get something when you come out, in other words.
Right, that's true. That's true. But at La Chorrera, we were attempting to, you know, deconstruct the space-time continuum and end history. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was a lot more ambitious than the Kickstarter. The Kickstarter was, let's give it a shot. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't. You know, if it doesn't work, I can always, you know, do Plan B and try and find a publisher to give me an advance. As it turned out, that wasn't necessary. But with La Chorrera, you know, there is no going back. I mean, there's no way you could try to repeat that experiment, you know, because in the first place, it's not an experiment. It was, I mean, we called it an experiment, but an experiment is, you could almost call it like the ritual at La Chorrera or the ceremony at La Chorrera or something, because an experiment, you have to have, to really qualify for that, you have to tightly control, you know, as many variables as you can so that you can, you know, that's the whole idea of doing a scientific experiment. And the very ideas that we were dealing with made that impossible, especially this idea of time, because, you know, Terrence was getting insights about the nature of time and the idea that time had a structure. The time is not just a place where you put events. It actually has a texture, you know, and it, to a certain degree, determines what kind of events can happen, you know, in within those times. So the idea that you could ever replicate any experiment is absurd, you know, and so
did you feel this way at the time?
When we were doing it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and then, so from then till now, I mean, do you still feel that way about time? Do you feel like that there's some issues ultimately with science in replicating, you know, experiments because of this?
Well, I don't know if it's because of that. I mean, there have been, you know, I think the notion that time has a structure is probably an interesting idea, you know. But I don't know how much you've studied the time wave or how much you know about it. I mean, this was something where Terrence and I eventually, you know, I mean, after a while, I became kind of a critic of the time wave. You know, I think it was a interesting mathematical construct. I think he had some real insights into the I Ching, and I think that, you know, probably his, you know, the discovery that you could use the hexagrams of the I Ching this way, you could string them along in a sequence and generate this wave, and then you could use that wave as a perfect 13-month lunar calendar. you know, I think it was a 384-day calendar. I think that was a brilliant insight.
Out of all the people that I've heard talk about, because I know the time wave zero fairly well, you know, I mean, I studied a little bit, and I didn't really get that much out of it, but I thought that aspect of it was just phenomenal, and it's so funny that I hear so many people talk about the La Traera experiment and the Terence McKenna, things like that, and they talk about psychedelics and his bardic ways and all of that, but hardly ever do I hear anybody talk about the fact that he discovered calendars in the I Ching. To me, that's an enormous find.
I think it's an enormous find, and it was actually an accidental find. I mean, it was a gift from hyperspace, or it was an insight that came out of this prolonged altered state. So in that sense, you know, it's not unlike other people, other people that have made discoveries using psychedelics, like, you know, Carrie Mullis and, who was it, Francis Crick and all these people finally got around to admitting that LSD had helped them conceptualize their ideas. Well, Carrie Mullis was not shy about saying that at all. In fact, you know, the Nobel Committee was a little bit nervous because they were afraid he was going to get up there and, you know, and so Terence got this insight about the structure of the I Ching and its relationship to, you know, lunar calendars and even DNA. I mean, he was not the first to notice that there was a similarity between the I Ching and DNA, because they're both based on 64, sure. Right? So if he had been a sinologist, which he wasn't, and he had made this discovery, he would have been hailed, and, you know, he would have had a reputation as a sinologist, and, you know, the dozen or so other sinologists in the world would have hailed him, and nobody else would have given a damn. Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of interesting that, you know, he wasn't content with that. He was saying, no, this isn't about rediscovering a Chinese calendar. This is about discovering that space-time has a fractal structure. And, you know, and that you can use this to map time and make predictions, particularly about where it's going to end, you know, because that built into the hypothesis was the idea that it has an end. Mm-hmm. It's an involuting spiral is, I guess, the idea, and the singularity, you know, is reflected on all levels. And as you get closer and closer to the singularity, things get weirder and weirder and weirder until finally the level of novelty reaches such a critical mass that, you know, it basically, you know, it is some kind of a singularity. Yeah. That was the hypothesis. But Well, you know, this is where I differ with Terence. The problem that I see with the time wave theory, you know, and we had many discussions about this over more than a decade, you know, more than two decades, we talked about this. But the problem, as I see it, is it's not a theory, because a theory has got to be testable. Mm-hmm. He could not state, what will disprove this theory? You know, what are the critical discoveries that would invalidate these assumptions? That's how science is supposed to work. You know, you develop a hypothesis, and then you work like crazy to disprove the hypothesis. And that's what you do, because then it lets you see the, you know, the chinks in your argument, and either revise the model, you know, or chuck the model out. And there was no way that the premises of the time theory could be tested, you know, other than to postulate that at some point in the future there was going to be a massive singularity, you know, that was the eschaton or the end of time or whatever. And you know, the work with the time wave became this exercise in Terrence's mind, mostly to try and figure out how do you fit the time wave against the known historical sequence of events. How do you achieve the best fit? Once you've achieved the best fit, then you can, then the end point is up there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And you can say, well, oh, well, okay, I've achieved what I think is the best fit. And what do you know? The end point is December 21st, 2012. And it just so happens to be the same date that the Mayans said that, you know, that the Mayans said was going to be the end of one of their major cycles, the 13th Bactoon or whatever it was. And, but they didn't really, you know, I mean, there are disputes about this. They didn't really say that at the end of that, that it was all going to be over with, you know. And they just sort of had this idea that another cycle of some sort begins. Terrence was saying, well, no, you know, this is the critical moment when the space-time continuum actually collapses or something happened. So if that's a test of the hypothesis, whatever the test is, if that's the test, then, you know, you have to say it failed spectacularly.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
it's so interesting to me that, like, you know, anybody else that would make a claim like this, that they've somehow discovered a time wave and that, you know, this sort of stuff, and then they were proven absolutely wrong, yet he's like the only guy that people still follow and listen to. And, you know, and it's, anybody else, it seems like they'd be like, oh, that guy was a total kook. But because Terrence had so many other things to say, so many other things to bring to the table, people could be like, okay, well, he got that wrong, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's true. And actually, in some ways, yeah, I'm glad that he had many other things to say. And his shtick was not totally about the time wave, because you're right. He would just be dismissed as a kook. And I actually, in some ways, I think that Terrence was wrong about the time wave, you know, but he was right about just about everything else. You know what I mean? I mean, if you just look at the way events have unfolded since then, if you look around and if you, you know, if you sort of cleave to this idea of novelty, which is what the time wave is all about, and this really goes back to Whitehead's ideas, mm-hmm. that, you know, novelty ingresses into the continuum, and the time wave is supposed to be a way to measure that. Not a crazy idea. It just wasn't really the instrument to do it. But if you just look around, and you know, novelty is busting out all over, and things are, in fact, getting much weirder than they have been. You know, there seems to be a general, you know, trend in the way events unfold toward a, I don't know what you call it, and in, well, call it novelty. You know, that's as good a word as any. There's a general ingression of novelty into the continuum that does seem to be accelerating. And, you know, so with, in some ways, I think the time wave, you know, it was his idea, and it was very much his pet, you know, project, but in some ways it was baggage. You know, I mm-hmm. think that his message might have been a lot clearer, you know, if he didn't have that, if he didn't have to keep defending that all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, but it didn't, you know, I mean, his message is certainly clear, and it's, you know, it's still very timely, and you just can't point, the mistake is, you just can't point to a single instant where the singularity reaches a critical mass. I don't think that's the way novelty works. I think that novelty does increase over time. It's just the notion that, well, there are new things under the sun, after all. I mean, today, something somewhere in the universe or on the planet or whatever is going to happen that never happened before in the history of the universe. Mm-hmm. You know, so novelty is there, but it does not erupt into the continuum. It sort of leaks into the continuum, you know, it sort of oozes into it. It's rare that the events are, you know, these abrupt punctate events. And I think that was, you know, that was another thing that, you know, Terrence got hung up on looking at these huge events and in an effort to try and
almost
give a, you know, try and position the time wave in history. He focused on huge events, you know, the explosion of the atomic bomb, the first, you know, discovery of DNA or whatever, you know, these things that were clearly significant events, but they don't really ingress into history in that way, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, what we see, what gets our attention, are the exciting historical events, like the first detonation of the atomic bomb. Well, is that the novel event? Or was it when Einstein, sitting in his study, dreamed up the equations that described how that could be done? Was that the novel event? Or was it the, you know, when they finally got a sustained chain reaction going at the University of Chicago, Oppenheimer and Fermi and those people? Was that it? You know, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, there's a really...
These are all novel events, but the one that got the attention was the spectacular one that, you know, incinerated Hiroshima.
Yeah. Well, you know, in one way, though, this the time wave and everything that you guys were doing down at La Chorrera sort of it hits the paradox of science in one way, that not everything can be put into a test tube. Not everything can just be repeated, and therefore, you know, just like the love that you have for somebody else is not something that can be scientifically verifiable in one respect. So
that's quite true.
Yeah. So it's almost like there's this sort of interplay between things that are, you know, qualitative and things are quantitative. And so it seems like some of the things that you guys were doing down there was sort of hitting that on, hitting head first, you know?
Well, yeah, we were confronted by it. We couldn't ignore it. And that might be one reason why, as you said before, Terrence, you know, stayed very much out in public. And I sort of stepped back, and that was a choice, really, on my part, you know, and a choice on his part as well. But you know, I mean, when we went through La Chorrera and came out the other side, he was ready to completely reject science. He was saying, this shows that science is practically useless. It's not up to the task of explaining what happened to us, you know, and so I reject science. I'm just going to go out and sort of become a metaphysician, really, and a spokesman for these ideas, but not really. I'm not really going to try and approach them scientifically, you know. And my attitude was, well, you know, we can't reject science. We can't reject science yet because we're not scientists, you know, and we don't know how science works. And in order to reject science, we have to be able to do science. And so that's the direction I took. I said, let's step back from it a little bit. Let's pull our elbows in from this whole, you know, conspiracy to collapse the space-time continuum. Let's do what science does very well, which is look at really, really, really small slices of reality. You know, mm-hmm. Science is a very good tool for dissecting minute segments of reality. But when it comes to putting all those things together into a whole comprehensive picture, it's not so good for
there's
that.
A lot of ground, yeah.
There's a lot of ground. And scientists should be always, I mean, I think it's a tremendous tool for asking questions of nature, you know, but you have to approach it humbly. And I think all scientists should reflect often on the limitations of their methodology, you know, because there's a tendency toward certain arrogance, you know, because it is powerful. But we have to remember that, you know, there will always be infinitely more that you don't know than that you do know. Mm-hmm. And so it's good to keep an open mind and, you know, and remember that, you know, science never proves anything. All it does is construct models. And the model could be overturned tomorrow. And that's the job of science, in a sense, is to, you know, you construct models, you construct ideas about how things might work, and then you assiduously chip away at it and see if you can demolish that model. You know, that's really what it's all about. And if you can, then it was a lousy model and it doesn't deserve to, you know, go on. It needs to be replaced by a better model. So slowly you get this evolution in ideas, you know. Now that's how science, you know, is supposed to work in an ideal vacuum. If it were just a pure, you know, quest for truth and beauty and knowledge, you know, but we know also in the real world science is not pursued that way. Mm-hmm. You know, scientists are human beings. The things that they do have an impact on society. There's often an objective, you know. It's not just that we want to understand, you know, how cancer works. We want to understand how cancer works so that we can cure cancer. I mean, yeah. that's the practical outcome. So priorities get changed, and, you know, science can't just be, you know, a pure, you know, probe into the unknown, although ideally it would be, but that's not the way science happens these days. Big science is, you know, it's requires funding, it requires infrastructures, it requires, you know, scientists and graduate students and all of the toys that science feels that it has to use to pursue its enterprise. So, you know, the day of the gentleman scientist like Darwin or someone who can, you know, just sit in his garden and be a careful observer of nature and have insights, I mean, maybe that goes on, but that kind of scientist is rare. Mm-hmm. I mean, we need more like that, you know, and I think that science... you know, I think that scientists sometimes, especially if they're involved in institutional science, it's very easy to essentially lose sight of what it's all about. You know, what it should be is the search for truth, to push back the frontiers, you know, of knowledge. But what it often is, it's about getting grants and publishing papers and, you know, going to conferences, making money and doing all the things the scientists do. And, you know, and that's great. That's part of the way it works. But what concerns me is about that is a lot of scientists, they get caught up in this and they really lose they forget what they really should be doing. They're too caught up in this that, you know, and they're going through the motions and they're not really thinking about it anymore. So they're not really scientists. They're technicians. You know, they become very clever technicians. They know how to use the machines. They know how to interpret the data, but they have a hard time connecting those activities with actually finding meaning in nature. That's what we're looking for is, you know, meaning. We're trying to explore the mind of God, if you want to put it that way. And, you know, and I don't, you know, I don't see a separation between the universe and God. I guess I'm a pantheist in that sense, you know.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, I do think the universe seems to be quite intelligently and elegantly organized, you know, not because there's an intelligent designer. I don't buy that. I say that it's just it's an intelligence that is intrinsically built into the structure of reality from the bottom to the top. You find it. And, you know, I think that scientists in their training, I think that it should be a requirement that they take philosophy of science, you know, at least a course or two in epistemology, maybe Whitehead's ideas and so on. Most of them don't, you know. I mean, there's not room in the scientific curriculum for that. But unfortunately, you know, they come out of it with all kinds of skills and very little sort of philosophical grasp of the endeavor that they're involved with.
Mm-hmm. You had just mentioned, you know, intelligence and nature of God, that sort of thing. You know, we talk about entheogens, which obviously you've dealt a lot with. And the general idea of that word is that they're God-inducing. And what does that mean to you? Like, years of dealing with this compound, what do you take from that? Like, well, where has this brought you spiritually, I guess is the question.
Well, I don't like the word entheogen.
You don't?
For one thing. No, I have a big bone to pick with that, because I think it's a misnomer. It is, as you say,
sure.
It generates God within. It's something that generates God. In theo, within, God, and generate. Well, okay, so I don't like it because, in the first place, they don't always do that, yeah. Right? They don't always generate mystical experiences.
Yeah, sometimes it's the fear of death and...
Right, all kinds of things. So that's, you know, entheogenesis is one of the things that that psychedelics can do, mm-hmm. you know, just like they can induce, you know, a paranoid trip or a... you know, a horror trip or, you know, or a blissful trip. They can do all these things. I much prefer psychedelic, even though, as a term, even though it's weighted down with all this 60s baggage, you know, but if you can divorce it from that and just think about the meaning of the word, which is, it means mind manifesting. So it's much broader than entheogenic and yeah, the psychedelics, that's what they do. They manifest the mind.
It's definitely more in line with actually what's going on, because your mind could be full of devils and demons or whatever, and then that's what exponentiates.
And psychedelics manifest whatever is out there, so yeah. It is more mind manifesting. Hopefully, they engender a mystical or blissful or meaningful experience, but not always. And then on the other side of the coin, you can look at something that, like, for example, kava is an example I like to use. It's not a psychedelic. It's not a hallucinogen. It's a, you know, it's a beverage that they use throughout Polynesia, and it's used for social interaction, and it kind of produces a mild calming effect. You probably taken it. It's you know, widely available, but under the definition that they're using, you could say, well, kava is an entheogen, you know, because it's what enables that society and those people to get in touch with, you know, whatever religious meaning they have around this plant. It is a sacred plant. They treat it as a sacred plant, but they also treat it totally casually. I mean, it's what people drink, you know, for any social gathering. So I don't like the term entheogen. I think that I think it's a misnomer. I think it misdescribes. I think psychedelic is much more straightforward and honest, you know, because things like mysticomimetic and, you know, psychotomimetic and all of these, you know, there's just a plethora of words to describe these substances, and that tells you something. It tells you that they're very hard to describe in words.
Yeah.
You know, there is no good word. So I just go with psychedelic and say, well, it's not perfect, but it's better than all the others.
When we look at guys like, you know, Francis Crick, you had mentioned earlier, I think that he had discovered the structure of DNA while he was on LSD, supposedly, right? That's the story, right? I know that I believe Steve Jobs had some major, epiphanies or whatever when he was on these. But besides the La Cerrera experiment, like, has there been like any sort of scientific discoveries that you've made while you're under the spell of these things, if you will?
Oh, well,
or even insights, not necessarily anything that you could, lay out in paper, but.
Well, yeah, I have had insights, and I think you've touched on an interesting point here. I don't know if you know the work of Simon Powell.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, Simon G. Powell. You've read Simon G. Powell. He wrote his latest book. Have you read his latest book?
No, I actually just heard last week that he had a new one out. So I'd watched the documentary that he had, and then the one before that. I forget what the book was called, but I read that. So,
well, he wrote Darwin's Unfinished Business. That was his second book. Something about exploring the intelligence of nature.
Yes,
and then the one before that was the Psilocybin Solution.
That's the one I read. Yes.
Yeah, okay. I quite like this guy's writing, and I like his thinking. He's very good at articulating this. This idea, and something he said in his last book, which I admit I haven't read the whole thing, but he asked me to review it so that I could give him a blurb, which I did. But what struck me in reading the sections that I read was that he's talking about science. Depends on instruments in a lot of ways for exploring the world. They extend our senses, right? We have microscopes and telescopes and spectroscopes and mass spectrometers and all this stuff. All this technology is basically something that we apply to observe and explain aspects of nature that we normally we can't even see them, So, they're ways of exploring nature. And a remark that he made in that book really struck me, which is that the psychedelics themselves are a scientific instrument,
Sure.
They are a lens that you can look through. You can look at phenomena in a psychedelic state and an unpsychedelic state, same phenomenon, and you will see things about that phenomenon on psychedelics that will escape your notice if you're not in that altered state. Mm-hmm. And it's not that those things aren't there. They are there. It's just that you don't notice them, in the unpsychedelic state. Because we're genetically programmed to suppress most of what's coming in. We focus on what's in the foreground, mm-hmm. what's right in front of us. One thing that I think psychedelics do that's interesting is they temporarily reverse that relationship. So things that are in the background that would normally not be noticed or would be ignored suddenly move to the center of attention, and you're seeing things and understanding things about phenomena that you may have never noticed before, simply because
you get a set of William Blake eyes, right?
Yeah, exactly. You see them from that perspective, and I think that's a very interesting observation. And I think that it was a casual observation, but I think it's quite profound if you think about it. Mm-hmm. The idea that you could take a person who's study a phenomenon for a long time, whatever it might be, knows everything supposedly there is to know about it. In other words, they really know their craft, or they know their subject. Then give them a psychedelic. Chances are they're going to have understandings about their specialty that never occurred to them before. Mm-hmm. And the question is, and that's tremendous. So it's psilocybin is a scientific instrument. Think of it as a kind of microscope, mm-hmm. and it will bring to your attention things that you've never noticed before. The tricky part is the day after do those insights stand up? Do they still hang together? And in a lot of cases, I think they do. Yeah, well, not all discoveries are equivalent to figuring out the structure of DNA. You know, I mean, that was a big one, but you can have insights in these altered states that give you insights into phenomena that it's just outside. So this ability to step outside a reference frame temporarily and look at phenomena, I think that's a tremendously useful thing that psychedelics bring to the table. You know, I mean, and you can imagine, I would love to have conferences or whatever, cosmologists and mathematicians and you know, structural engineers, people in different specialties, if you could get them together and get everybody loaded on psilocybin or ayahuasca, mm-hmm. I think some very interesting ideas might come out of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're tools for you know, understanding the nature of the world, and I think, you know, if you, I mean, you can, in another context, you can say, well, okay, indigenous people, if you go through the forest with a person, a shaman or whatever, who is in an altered state most of the time, and who also, you know, even when he's not on a psychedelic, his brain state is different than ours, mm-hmm. because it's much more gestalt. And things like literacy and Western civilization and you know, Western religions, all of these assumptions and conditioning and bodies of knowledge, in some way they're baggage. To one thing psychedelics let you do is they let you shed that baggage, sure. temporarily, and just perceive the universe, the world outside, in a direct way, with no intervention, you know, no little voice narrating what this is all about. And I think indigenous people are pretty much more in that stage. They're much more immersed in their environment, not separate from it. Mm-hmm. They don't have something like a point of view. You know, that's a invention of literacy and I mean, I suppose they do now. I don't know if there's a, you know, a truly illiterate or pre-literate indigenous person. But if you go into the environment with such a person more tuned in to what's going on, they will notice things about the environment that you're just not going to see until they point it out. Mm-hmm. Then if they point it out, you can say, oh, yeah, I see this now. You know, so I think they're useful in that sense.
It just makes me wonder how many people that have been in a psychedelic state might have had some crazy revelatory insight or whatever, but coming back into sobriety, they didn't know how to deal with it intellectually or philosophically or whatever. And then also, on the other hand, how many people that are well-versed in their intellectual arena, whatever it is, philosophically, that sort of thing, but never go into the psychedelic state to get that other perspective, if you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. That's the problem. The people that are, you know, that have these crazy ideas, if they can't defend them intellectually or scientifically or on some level epistemologically, they will just be dismissed as, you know, you're crazy. I mean, this is, you know, you're just deluded and, you know, you're a stoner. And this is, you know, unfortunately, the first impulse is to, you know, to laugh, to ridicule it. And we sort of, you know, in a sort of nervous way, right? We diffuse it by ridiculing it, you know, and that's the first reaction. But if you can get past that, if you can, you know, then I think there are insights to be had. And then on the other side, the people that are very well defended with their, you know, epistemological frameworks or whatever, those people too could benefit by having their notions challenged. I think Aldous Huxley famously said, you know, the people that should take psychedelics are the people that think they know what's what. You know, they're good for that. I mean, so they are a humbling experience, and in that sense, they're tremendous, tremendous learning experience, again, because they remind us that, you know, how little we know, and that there is an aspect of reality, you know, way beyond the safe boundaries of this model that we've created that is consistent with what we think we know. But, you know, we shouldn't forget that it's a model. It is not reality. It is a model of reality that we're inhabiting. We're living in the, you know, serotonin hallucination at the moment. Sure. You know, the brain generates a reality and we proceed to inhabit it. It has to for survival purposes, mm-hmm. but it is not the same as reality. So if you could bring these things together, I think you'd really have something, you know, both intellectual rigor and the ability to step outside all of those frameworks and look at it almost from a like an aerial view or an extra dimensional view or something. You know, there's a lot to be, you know, psychedelics have a lot to teach us just as learning tools.
In one respect, trying to create a model of reality without experiencing this to me seems a little foolish.
Well, yeah, because absolutely, because your model of reality is therefore incomplete,
yeah.
Right? I mean, if it doesn't take into account that these states of minds are possible, then, you know, it's an incomplete model. It's absolutely an incomplete model.
Yeah.
So you have to take these into account, and you can say, well, okay, this gets into the, you know, you can say, well, it's just a, you know, it's a neurochemical brain state, right? Mm-hmm. You can say it's just some odd neurochemical brain state, as though this is an explanation. Yeah. You know,
normal consciousness is, right? Anyway,
I mean, can you name anything that is not a neurochemical brain state?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's what we are. You know, we're caged inside our brains, and we perceive the world through these sensory neural filters, and the brain is a machine that you know, takes the raw datum from the outside world through these sensory neural filters and sort of, you know, blends it all together and mixes it all up and extrudes it into something that we call reality, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's not, it's a you know, it's a story that we've made up. We're writing the script even as we live out the movie that we're, you know, we're the producer and director and the star of, you know, of this whole thing. And the unknowable real world remains unknowable. Mm-hmm. and hopefully real. But we can't even say that.
I know. I just one last comment here. We're just about out of time, but I know one thing that you always said is that, you know, what the thing that the ayahuasca or the psilocybin always said was that you don't know shit, monkeys. I had heard you say that before. I thought it was so funny.
Something I say. Yes, that's right.
Do you think that we can ever know shit, if you will? I mean, you know, for the sense of a joke, like shit's an anagram for this. So in what right. respect can we ever right. know this?
Well, yeah, I think we can know more and more and more, you know. I mean, and that's one of the lovely things about being alive and about being curious and about, you know, about having tools like science is they're powerful tools for sort of, you know, bringing into the sphere of human knowledge more data, more understanding, enhanced understanding. But, you know, it's still a very, if human understanding is an expanding sphere, you know, I mean, I think it is an expanding sphere, but remember, it's expanding in a space where if the unknown is on the outside of that sphere, it's infinitely more extensive, you
sure.
know?
Yeah.
So that's either depressing, you know, to some people, they would say, well, what's the point? We're never going to know everything. That's right. And other people would say, well, that's wonderful, because there'll always be novelty. There'll always be new discoveries to be made. I'm kind of, you know, on that side. I mean, I like learning. I like enjoying new things. But I'm comfortable with the idea that actually we don't know shit. You know, we'll probably never have the thing fully figured out. And that's good.
And that's okay, right?
Yeah, that's okay. That's a testimony to our limitations, but also to the fact that, you know, there is no end to the mystery and the marvel that is existence.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's
it. It gives us something to talk about in podcasts like this, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And with that, that's a great way to end this. Hey, thanks a lot for speaking with me, man. This has been a real pleasure. I hope the best for you in the future and everything. Do you want to plug some of your websites and stuff like that before we go?
No, I think that was the main one. Okay. I mean, well, I can say, you know, The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss is the name of my book. You can order it off Amazon and the website of the same name. And I don't know how many of your readers, they're probably a fairly psychedelic audience that you have. But I want to mention the Hefter Research Institute, which is kind of like MAPS, but much less well known. But actually, in some ways, we're doing some very good work. Most of the leading researchers are on the Hefter board, and we're funding a lot of the work that's going on with psilocybin now. So if people are interested in that, they can go to hefter.org, H-E-F-F-T-E-R, and have a look at our board and some of the research that we're helping to fund. We don't have deep pockets, but we have donors who have deep pockets, and they've been very generous in helping us get some of these clinical studies with psilocybin underway. You know, as you actually get closer to getting some of these things into medicine and getting them moving toward approval, it just gets more and more and more expensive, because you have to do, you know, you have to do big studies with lots of people. Eventually, though, I think this is going to pay off. I think something like psilocybin is probably going to be available in medicine for therapy, off probably for hospice use and that sort of thing. I would say 5 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And that's going to revolutionize medicine.
Yeah. So Big Pharma's not just cutting you guys a check.
They can't see the revenue model.
Exactly.
I'm sure they would if they could figure out how to make money about
exactly.
it. But it's not going to happen that way.
Unfortunately. So.
Yeah.
So. All right. Dennis, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it. I know you're doing a lot of traveling, so good luck with all that and best in the future.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Let me know when the cast is up so I can put it on my website and let folks know about it.
I will. I'll send you an email.
Okay.
All right, cool.
All right. Have a great night.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Our outro song is entitled The Only Girl and is provided by the Portland, Oregon band 3 for Silver. This tune is super catchy and groovy, and the vocalist Willow Certain has a great, genuine voice for their traditional world folk sound. This trio has 2 full-length studio records available, as well as a live album available on their site, 3forsilver.tumblr.com. And if you are in the Pacific Northwest area, these cats play all over, so go check them out. Thanks for tuning in to the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, everyone. I really appreciate all the listeners and all the people who have supported these last 28 episodes.
I hope you have learned something new, were inspired, and I hope all of these wonderful guests have helped you expand your consciousness in some way. I know this show has helped me in my own intellectual and philosophical musings, so I hope you got as much out of it as I have. If all goes as planned, I will hopefully see you guys in a few months. Until then, always remember, an opinion without pie is just an onion. Thanks.
Listening to the Marty Leeds Mathemagical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com, and be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.